Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Everybody loves a good song, but did you ever wonder exactly what goes into creating one? Singer-songwriters Tyler Nail and Jonathan Luce have been asking that very question of themselves for most of their adult lives. They've got a few ideas, and they're here to share during the second annual Songwriters Sessions in Winston-Salem. Then, it's time to break out your Vegemite sandwiches and have a good day with the Wake Forest University Theater Department production of Our Country's Good, a 19th century Australian penal colony and a chance at redemption for its inhabitants through one life-changing theatrical experience. It's certainly changing perceptions among the talented Wake student actors, and they're here to explain how. And Dale Pollack takes us behind the scenes to help us make sense of current film and theater trends and just who is borrowing from whom these days. Meanwhile, they'll be keeping it authentic big time this weekend at the Surrey Old Time Fiddlers Convention. Fiddler Nick McMillan and bassist Buck Buckner will take a step back in time with us next after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we've got lots of great music for you today with some amazing old-time fiddling on the way in the second half of the show. Backstep members Nick McMillan and Buck Buckner are here, and we've got great theater and film to boot. But first, we dive headfirst into the art of the song.
Oh, Father Time, why you changing everything? I'm looking for the light, but it never stays the same.
Songwriter sessions are typically a chance to be a fly on the wall as musicians perform their original songs and then share their thoughts, feelings, and opinions on the fine art of songwriting. This Saturday night, March 29th, those four walls will be the Community Arts Cafe. Winston-Salem Songwriter Sessions 2014 kicks off at 8 o'clock with performances by local artists Tyler Nail, Jonathan Luce, and Colin Alured. I'll be emceeing the event, and after each song, I'll ask a selfish question or two of the artists, sort of like a live version of Triad Arts Weekend. But on Saturday, I'll be inviting audience members to chime in with questions or comments of their own. For a little sample of what you can expect, last week, Tyler and Jonathan dropped by to speak with me about songwriting. Tyler's a songwriter, singer, guitarist, drummer, and producer from Winston-Salem. Jonathan is a singer-songwriter, guitarist, recording engineer, and producer from Advance. The two artists have partnered on several projects, including their homage to the late Levon Helm. That recording is titled When I Go Away. We'll be sampling from their new music throughout the interview.
Well, I don't suppose that I have a more thorough understanding of songwriting than anybody that's pursuing songwriting, but I write songs all the time. That's what I do. That's what I've done for the last 7 years or so. And the other things, the drumming and the guitar playing and singing and producing, all that gives me a pretty thorough examination of the songs. I play guitar, and that's my melodic instrument. And then the drums gives me a sense of rhythm and stuff. So I have those two things covered, but without, like, I don't, like, get lost in, like, composition and stuff. I don't get the play piano a lot or any of these instruments that, like, would really require some, like, vast, like, collaboration with the guitar to fit in. I kind of use the guitar as the composition instrument, and I use the drums and my knowledge of the drums as the rhythmic side of things.
Okay, Jonathan, you have a wide-ranging background as well as both singer, really accomplished guitarist as well, and doing some recording and production work. If you're writing a tune, are you ever thinking in terms of production elements you'd bring to it early on and therefore you would write it a certain way, or how does it seep into your...
Sometimes it's something that you consider a little more frequently. You know what the end product might be. You're thinking about, okay, I want this song to be a little more rhythmically driven with drums or something like that. Other times it's not. Other times it's just you and a guitar, or it starts with a melody or a lyric, and it's real simple, and it's not really focused on the end product as a piece of production with a lot of different musicians. So it's kind of a combination of both.
You know, you guys collaborate frequently, and then you also front your own band. Mm-hmm. That shift of roles and what that means just musically for you, when you're out front and center versus playing primarily guitar stuff.
Me and Tyler met, I don't know, a while ago. We've been playing together for about 3 years, and we really hit it off in terms of kind of on the same page with writing and creativity and everything and the way we approached music and what we liked about it. And being the guitarist in the band gave me an opportunity to explore guitar playing and be better at it. And I play exclusively acoustic guitar. And as the lead guitar player, that opened me up to a realm of bluegrass, flat picking styles, and things like that that I hadn't really explored before. It was exciting to build up some chops in that area and get better at playing guitar. And then, you know, I just really, you know, like his music, and like I said, we click real well, so it's good doing that. Me doing my own project, it's my songwriting, so it's lyrically driven, it's the lyrics that I come up with, it's the poetry that I can investigate and channel of my own way. So that's the difference. I'm a little more technically musician-oriented with Tyler's project, and then, of course, fronting my own is, you know, I'm a singer, and I write the songs. So
the song,
and he plays the drums.
That's right. And you're, from just the collaborative nature of your all's work together, how have you guys grown musically together over those 3 years? And that's a big chunk of time to be jamming together.
We're aware of each other's strengths and where we're comfortable and what we can ask of one another. And it's to the point where it's not really a consideration. It just works. Also, I think being around each other separate from music and getting to know each other personally more along the lines and having more conversations. We obviously talk about songwriting, but we talk about all kinds of different things. And I think that bleeds in to what comes out of the music, probably specifically songwriting, you know, what we kind of talk about and internalize and the way we approach songwriting, if there are overlaps or if there are wide disparities, I think.
Yeah, I think all that is spot on. And also, I think something that John and I have developed over the last few years is this trust in leading bands, which sounds strange in the setting we're talking about, because more commonly I'm leading a three-piece band, and so it doesn't take as much leading as it used to. But we used to have a regular gig with like a six-piece band, and John's band is often bigger than mine. And a cool thing in our relationship that we've developed is taking the role as like number one and two of band leading, which is cool because when I'm singing and when I'm like unable to, when I'm in a position when we're performing, when I'm not able to lead the band, then it becomes John's job. And John is able to pick up that job because he's so familiar with my vision and like what I'm going for. And then I'm able to do the same in his band where we just kind of shift these roles of making sure that what we're trying to, you know, capture is coming across the right way. That's something that's pretty cool, I think.
We live on the county line between the corn and the Georgia pine. We'll spend our money and save our time. Look out on the county line.
I've been curious about these Red House songwriter sessions. Talk about the format of these sessions and how folks are selected or become involved in it.
Well, John and I have been talking about doing this for a while. John and I live in the Red House, which is a red house that we live in. We, for like the first year, we talked about the Red House sessions and what we thought they would be if we ever started doing them. And we wanted to make it revolve around songwriting. We wanted to include songwriters from out of town and stuff, but we didn't know exactly what we wanted to do. So finally, we just landed on this format where we wanted to do it in two parts. We have songwriters come over to our house. We have a beverage of their liking, might be coffee or whiskey or beer or something. And we listen to a record, and the record kind of references them in some way. It's like maybe a record they like or one that reminds us of the songwriter. And we talk to the songwriter for, you know, a little while, get a good discussion going about songwriting and the way it works for them, the way they understand it. And then part two comes around and we do a performance, and they perform, and it might be them on their own, or it might be they might let us play with them, but it's all just filmed and it's right there in our house. It's real comfortable. It's all just around music, but around conversation and around, you know, good atmosphere. That's kind of what it's about.
Sounds good. Now, let's get into Winston-Salem's songwriter session. We've got the benefit of hindsight. We can look back on last year's session, second which annual. Was a lot of fun. Yeah, the second annual. Congratulations.
Yeah.
describe the scene from last year's show. I mean, I'll let you guys do that. I happen to, in full disclosure, I hosted last year's songwriter session in Winston, and kind of looking back on it, what was it like there?
I thought it was the most appropriate setting that we could have expected for it. Like when you think of a songwriter discussion thing, an event where songwriters are talking about songwriting, I thought the CAC was a really good spot for us to do that. I thought the mood of the evening was perfect for it. It was a perfect setting. I mean, it was a great setting, and I think that we, the songwriters, it was myself and John and Kike Rodriguez Pastor and Andrew Lazar, and I think we were all surprised at how much sincerity just the setting brought out of us, and it made us really feel excited about talking about the songs and where they came from and stuff, and it made us feel like just the setting itself and the audience that night made us feel like it was easy to draw that stuff out of us because it felt like the audience really was invested in knowing it.
They were listening.
Very yeah. much engaged, and you think of that there's a Q&A format to this, you know. Initially coming into that, I thought, okay, the Q&A, how's that going to go? Does anybody have any questions? It's going to be like after a lecture and no one raises their hand.
Listen for the crickets.
Yeah, right. People came right up, like hands were being raised and good questions were being asked that made us think and laugh and talk amongst one another. And, you know, you did a great job hosting it and kind of facilitating that discussion. That was something that was really impressive, I thought, the audience engagement.
Very enjoyable all the way around. And as you mentioned, CAC, should remind listeners, CAC, Community Arts Cafe, downtown on 4th Street. And neat venue in terms of the sound because of the clarity. You can actually hear the music. You don't need to crank up the volume. It gets back to the back rows. And I appreciate that as a listener. I'm into hearing the sound and the different instruments and the voicings. And if you're a music lover, you'll like it there. So what are you going to tweak from last year, though? What sorts of things do you want to change up, keep new, keep fresh?
Well, one thing we changed was rather than have four songwriters, we're going to have three. It's going to be myself, Jonathan, and Colin Allured. We feel like this will give us the opportunity to play through more songs and offer more insight to the songs than having four and it being limited in any way.
Yeah, that's nice.
That's probably one of the more obvious changes.
Tell me a little bit about Colin. I guess I met him first at Arts for Life, doing some amazing work with young patients at Brenner's yep. and fighting through horrible illnesses and filling their life with song, but a very talented songwriter.
He is, and he is still doing that, and he also plays in the Breathing Room. He is just very accomplished. I think he comes from a bit of a classically trained background, plays all types of instruments, phenomenal guitar player, phenomenal songwriter, also plays different African instruments and everything, and is very just connected to music and the way it's able to affect people's lives, and which, you know, speaks to what he's doing over there, Arts for Life.
Dream I've been standing by. What of this is left behind? The fool inside of me.
What makes this this songwriter event unique from all the other like music events going on in Winston-Salem, from your standpoint, Tyler?
What's usually the case when you go see music is there's a bit of a barrier between the stage and the floor. There's this unspoken bit of privacy that a band sometimes requires to perform, and there's usually just a space between the audience and the band for the band to strictly perform, for them to put out what they're doing and an audience react to it, whether it be dance or whether it be just listen and applaud. But in this case, we're doing away with that with events like this, which this isn't the only event of its kind, but with this event and events like this, that idea is done away with, and we invite the audience to not only participate in some kind of physical way like dancing, but when they hear these songs and they find a curiosity about them or they have their own experience with them and react to them, we're inviting them to indulge themselves in that and to ask us what that is and to, investigate their curiosity and do it directly to the songwriter, ask us what's going on. That's what I think is so cool about it, because it instead becomes this thing where the audience and the songwriters are having a very similar, if not the same, experience with each other in everything.
I would say, along with that being that the fourth wall has broken down and everybody is, we encourage the audience to participate. I think because we're talking about creativity and creating lines, what's interesting is that the audience is invited to see how that relates to themselves, whether or not they're a songwriter or a writer of any kind, how the creative process relates to them. And I think we got some of that last year from the audience. That's where those questions come from. Like, oh, I understand certain aspects of what they're talking about in terms of creativity. So
you can take it where you live. I mean, you can take it at any level. And I think that whole idea of breaking down barriers is a good one, in that particularly in this country, not so much in elsewhere around the world where everyone's encouraged to make music and bang on a guitar or whatever. Mm-hmm. Here, there's this mentality where you either, oh, you're the gifted guy who's a musician type, or oh, no, I never had that, so I can't even get anywhere. It makes it so unapproachable in a way, but you all are doing a good job of kind of bridging that gap, I think, with this sort of format. Jonathan Luce, Tyler Nail, thanks so much for spending some time with me today.
Thank you, David.
Then you came along and you brought the sun with you.
Singer-songwriters Tyler Nail and Jonathan Luce. We've been sampling from their music, and you'll find links to more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. In February of 2014, Tyler and Jonathan, together with local singer-songwriter Kike Rodriguez Pastor, began the Red House Songwriter Sessions. You'll find links to YouTube video of the Red House Songwriter Sessions on our website, WFDD.org. Meanwhile, Tyler and Jonathan's annual Winston-Salem Songwriter Sessions is this Saturday night, March 29th at 8 o'clock in the Community Arts Cafe in downtown Winston-Salem. This year, joining Tyler and Jonathan on Saturday will be singer-songwriter Colin Allured, and all three artists will perform original songs of their own and then take questions from the audience about songwriting and whatever else comes to mind. I'll be moderating the event, and I look forward to hearing your questions, too. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a little break from the action right now. When we return, just about 60 seconds from now, it'll be a play within a play that's actually a powerful historical drama about the power of theater. Our Country's Good, with Wake Forest University Theater Department's Sharon Andrews and four thoughtful young actors who may just surprise you next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we've got two of the most talented old-time musicians on the planet with us in the second half of the show. First place fiddle winner at both Mount Airy and Galax, Virginia Fiddlers Conventions, Nick McMillan is here, and backstep bassist and vocalist Buck Buckner joins him. And American film producer, writer, and film professor Mr. Dale Pollack has a lot on his mind today, and he'll take us behind the scenes to share the latest on all the borrowing that goes on between Hollywood and the Great White Way. But first, speaking of theater, when was the last time you saw a historical drama that has it all? Intensity, thoughtful writing where every line moves the plot forward somehow, heartfelt and passionate but humorous all the same. Well, Our Country's Good has all that and a bag of Vegemite chips. The year is 1789 in the penal colony of Sydney, where a young married lieutenant is in the midst of directing a play with a ragtag cast of convicts and a leading lady who may be about to be hanged. Rehearsals for this restoration comedy are not going well, but as the barriers between captors and captives begin to break down during the course of this play within a play, they start to discover each other, both on stage and behind the scenes. The UK's Sunday Express called it one of the great plays of and about the theater, with overwhelming warmth and humanity. And next weekend, Wake Forest University Theater Department will bring this Olivier and Tony Award-winning play to the Triad. Arguing the merits of allowing criminals to perform a play, Captain Arthur Phillips says, quote, "The theater is an expression of civilization. For a few hours, we will no longer be despised prisoners and hated jailers." Wake Forest University student actor Philip Kaiser utters those words in his role as the captain. He's joined in the studio by fellow actors Joanna Beach, who plays Mary Brenham, Nate Brickhouse, who plays Major Robbie Ross, RM, and convict Ketch Freeman, and Emily Nedvedek, who plays convict Dabby Bryant, and Lieutenant William Fatty, RM. They were joined by Wake Forest University Associate Professor of Theater and Director of Our Country's Good, Sharon Andrews.
I would rather counsel than command. I don't propose this with the authority of a parent, but as the advice of your friend.
Friend? That's a good word. Short, but full of promise.
That you would take the coach this moment and go into the country.
Country can mean opposite things. It renews you with trees and grass. You go rest in the country. Or it crushes you with power. You die for your country. Your country doesn't want you. You're thrown out of your country. I like words. My father cleared the houses of the dead to sell the old clothes to the poorhouses by the Thames. He found a dictionary, Johnson's dictionary. It was as big as a Bible. It went from A to L. I started with the A's. Abecedarian, one who teaches the alphabet or rudiments of literature. Abject, a man without hope.
What does indulgent mean?
It means ready to overlook faults. You have to be careful with words that begin with in. It can turn everything upside down. Injustice. Most of that word is taken up with justice, but the in twists it inside out and makes it the ugliest word in the English language.
Guilty is an uglier word.
Innocent ought to be a beautiful word, but it isn't. It's full of sorrow, anguish.
Pretty impressive accents all the way around. And what's the difference? And what makes it more challenging or less?
Well, with this play, it's tricky because we are coming straight from Britain to Australia. So there's mostly a British influence, but then we are playing multiple roles. So when we're officers, it's RP and very refined British dialect versus when we're the convicts. My character specifically is from Devon. So that's a kind of South London on the coast kind of country accent. So that's its own thing entirely and kind of has a pirate sound to it versus there's a lot of other convict accents like South London or North London. For RP, it was a lot easier because it's very standardized. But for the convict accents, we all have very different twangs and tinges that we had to sort of work on our own and try to develop a character voice for that.
Also, when we're doing the show, it's very important to be able to switch back and forth between those accents literally in a moment's notice. We'll go from one scene doing one character immediately to throwing on a coat and wig and being a governor of those same convicts. So it's important to work on where those sounds live within our mouths and being well rehearsed in switching back and forth.
We have a really great dialect coach, Leah Roy, who's been working with us. And so we've all had the opportunity to work individually with Leah, and she's come to many of our rehearsals. And so that has been helpful to have someone else kind of hearing what we're, you know, practicing and leading us through that process.
And I should say WFTD's own Leah Roy, who she does support for WFTD, comes from. She's got a beautiful voice and a Shakespearean actress herself and very talented. Just from a pure process standpoint, what are some of the guttural things you do or don't do to kind of shift from the Royal British English into the more the country accent, that sort of thing?
Me personally, I play one character who's Irish and the other who's Scottish, which is a challenge, but also it's a little bit of a gift because the accents are so different that it helps distinguish the characters, and you can build off that by their body language and the way that they talk, and the lines themselves really fuel that as well. So the accents are challenging, but they're also a way to help you develop the characters even further.
All right, Nate, will you just set yourself up for showtime? I want a little Irish brogue and then a little Scottish, is it Scottish brogue too?
I don't even know. I guess.
How about back to back? Let's start with a little Irish.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing just swell. How about yourself?
I'm doing fine.
Okay, now, Scotty.
Good morning, sir.
Hi, good morning to you. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. I can't complain.
Ah, so everything was kind of down there, and everything was more up on the Irish. Could you explain what we just heard? Because it's fascinating. It really is quite a difference.
Well, for me, the Scottish character is Robbie Ross. He's the highest-ranking Marine in this colony, and he is very much opposed to the convicts being in a play. He thinks that it will humanize them, and he thinks that this is actually a very dangerous thing. In contrast to that, Irish, the convict that I play, is the hangman. And although he is the hangman, he's extremely friendly and he tries to be friends with everybody. And so I try to use the accent to help me increase that friendliness and help the audience just understand what a friendly guy Ketch Freeman, the Irish convict, is trying to be.
Philip, it seems like the underpinnings of this, a very philosophical conversation goes on to kind of set this up and this whole notion of the impact of, in a positive way, of theater on the populace.
Yes, my character is the one who is responsible for deciding to put on the play. So the philosophical theories behind that are based off of Socrates, and one of his famous dialogues called the Meno is referenced in the play. And it's the philosophy that if you give someone who is used to having nothing, someone like a slave who is just full of loathing and treated like an animal their entire life, that if you show them a little humanity, treat them with kindness, and give them an opportunity to grow as a person, that they will become human again and can become better people from just a little tiny opportunity for growth.
Are you remembering your lines, Dabby?
What lines? No, I was remembering Devon. I was on my way back to Big Berry Bay.
You promised Lieutenant Clark you'd learn your lines.
I want to go back. I want to see the Atlantic. I want to hear a wall of stone breaking into an estuary. I can bring a boat into any harbor in any weather. I can do it as well as a governor.
Dabby, what about your lines?
I'm not spending the rest of my life in this flat, brittle, burnt-out country. Oh, give me some English rain.
It rains here.
It's not the same. I could recognize English rain anywhere. And Devon rain, Mary, Devon rain is the softest in England. As soft as your breasts. As soft as Lieutenant Clark's dimpled cheeks.
Dabby, don't.
You're wasting time, girl. He's ripe for the plucking. You can always tell with men, they begin to walk sideways. And if you don't...
Don't start. I listened to you once before.
What would you have done without that lanky sailor drooling over you?
I would have been less of a whore.
Listen, my darling. You're only a virgin once. You can't go to a man and say, I'm a virgin, except for this one lover I had. After that, it doesn't matter how many men run through you.
I'll never wash the sin away.
If God didn't want women to be oars, he shouldn't have created men who pay for their bodies. While you were with your little sailor, there were women in that stinking pit of a hold who had three men on them at once. Men with the pox, men with the flux, men biting like dogs.
But if you don't agree to it, then you're not a whore. You're a martyr.
You have to be a virgin to be a martyr, Mary. And you didn't come on that ship a virgin. A-H, I love thee to the heart, tattooed way up there.
That was different. That was love.
And Mary and Dabney, you get at you hinted at that read-through, another underpinning of the story, this whole issue of redemption.
I think that a lot of convicts were typically treated with just punishment their whole life, and so now they've got this opportunity to put on a play, and they've got some officers treating them like humans, and it's amazing the feelings of, you know, when you've been deprived of something your whole life, and then people start actually treating you like you matter and like you're important, then there's this desire to please and to help them and, you know, to do well in your lines and to learn your lines, or you realize that, like, you do have worth and you can contribute to this society in the future. And for Dabby particularly, she's very jaded going in and is very, well, it's, you know, sell your body or there's no other option, I guess. And so she is very much trying to convince Mary that we need to take advantage of these officers or do what you can when you can, take power when you can, because they're not going to give you anything. But through the course of the play, you really see how much Ralph and some of the other officers are really just trying to enlist us to help him. And it's really amazing how much, I guess, he does humanize us through this process.
Joe, how does this line of reasoning, or I guess the play in general, if at all, impact the way you approach, say, today's legal system or incarceration setup?
We read an article about a man who experienced a troupe of actors coming in and coaching them in a play and teaching them how to act when he was in prison. And he said, the most powerful quote to me was, we were no longer prisoners, we were actors. We also had a guest come in and speak with us the other night about his experience in the system and getting out and how important it was for him to feel like a human again, and that he now is going and speaking to all these people and having a huge impact through his public speaking and telling his story to people. And I think that it just shows an argument for redemption and for rehabilitation of convicts in many cases, and how their lives can be turned around through an opportunity to do good and do something with their lives other than, you know, how they started.
How do you all feel about this idea of taking the show on the road literally into a correctional facility? That's an unusual venue.
I think that has to deal with the whole theory behind the play of treating people with humanity and respect. In a lot of cases, these convicts might not be being treated with respect. They might not, you know, have a venue to talk about theater or the arts. And doing this, I guess, is kind of putting the play and its whole main idea and main focus into action in a very practical setting.
Sharon, thousands and thousands of plays out there. Why this one? It's a remarkable play in that it's a play within a play, as you said, and then also within that, the language that we hear in these reads, I mean, it really reveals the character instantaneously. It's just good writing.
It is very good writing. And there are things that happen in the writing that you continue to discover over and over again. Like my ear heard the other night a character say the word escape. And two lines later, a character who has been trying to escape rushes into the scene and tries to hide himself in and amongst all the other actors who are rehearsing. So you just begin to realize that there's no wasted words. And it's a lot about words. It's about the power of words. It's about the power of art. And she weaves that in an amazing way.
Every word it's not thrown out there. It moves the story forward in a way that you're not even perceiving it. That seems to be like a hallmark.
It is. And the actors are at the place reaching this level where you really are following all the threads of the story and all the threads of your character. Takes a lot of time and a lot of focus. And the actors are really beginning now to find those threads and to have those little epiphanous moments where they go, oh yeah, that's where that comes from.
Wake Forest University Associate Professor of Theater and Director of Our Country's Good, Sharon Andrews. She was joined by student actors Philip Kaiser, Joanna Beach, Nate Brickhouse, and Emily Nedvedek. The Tony Award-winning play, Our Country's Good, opens Friday night, April 4th at 7:30, and it'll run through the 13th on the Main Stage Theater. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And we'll take another short little intermission now. We'll return with UNC School of the Arts film professor, Mr. Dale Pollack. Today, Dale takes us behind the scenes for a look at the frequent cross-pollination that goes on between movies and Broadway. Seems to be a one-way street these days. And we'll wrap things up today with some good old-timey tunes by two of today's finest. Fiddler Nick McMillan and bassist vocalist Buck Buckner bring us a preview of the 5th Annual Surrey Old Time Fiddlers Convention next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we've got some outstanding old-time music for you with Backstep in just a minute. Before we break out our dancing clogs, though, American film producer, writer, and UNC School of the Arts film professor, Mr. Dale Pollack, has a lot in his mind, and he's here to peel back the curtains and take us behind the scenes to share.
Most movies used to come from Broadway. Not just the musicals like Chicago, Oklahoma, Kiss Me, Kate, My Fair Lady, but also straight dramatic plays such as Death of a Salesman or A Raisin in the Sun. But now films like Matilda, Kinky Boots, Legally Blonde, Billy Elliot, and Spamalot are the inspiration for Broadway. The one-way street has turned completely in the other direction. We can say Disney was one of the companies that really changed the rules of this game by taking its animated hits like Beauty and the Beast and The Lion King and turning them into giant hit musicals. The Lion King still continues to outgross any other musical on Broadway, and it all began as a film. So really, what does it matter where plays or movies come from? Well, on one level, it doesn't, as long as the entertainment is good. But the idea of creativity is, I think, a key one. Playwrights used to love writing for the stage and hoping their play might be turned into a movie. Are screenwriters doing the same thing now? Are they writing films with an eye on the stage version that will be down the road? Some say it's a sign of intellectual bankruptcy in the theater world. Now, of course, Hollywood has never been accused of being overly creative either. But there are a lot more successful movies in the last two decades than there have been successful original plays. So the stealing ends up being one way. We even see musicals started out as straight films. Stephen Sondheim turned All About Eve into Applause. A B-movie like Little Shop of Horrors became a giant Broadway hit, and Hairspray, a rather obscure John Waters movie, became a huge hit on the stage and is now done in regional theaters all over the country. One term that I saw in my research on this subject was adaptation decay. The idea is we keep readapting material, it gets further and further away from what the original was. And we can see that the charm of Roald Dahl's Chocolate Factory first got turned into a film with Gene Wilder, remade as a movie by Tim Burton, and failed miserably as a Broadway musical. And a lot of people felt the remake of the movie didn't improve on the original. So sometimes maybe movies should just stay movies and plays should just stay plays, but today's intellectual property world doesn't really allow that to happen. So we're going to see additional adaptation decay as movies move further and further away from their source. And at some point, maybe Netflix series will become musicals and will go yet another step. I can see it right now. House of Cards, the musical.
University of North Carolina School of the Arts film professor Mr. Dale Pollack. And that's a little old segment we like to call Behind the Scenes. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And the 5th annual Surrey Old Time Fiddlers Convention rounds out the month of March with award-winning musicians, free workshops, great food, and lots of dance. There'll also be luthier displays, band competitions, and outstanding live performances by the Mountain Park Old Time Band, Slate Mountain Ramblers, and Backstep. Backstep members bassist Buck Buckner and fiddler Nick McMillan are co-organizers.
The Round Peak music is basically the music from a very small area in Surrey County that's Round Peak. There's a little round mountain over there in a Round Peak, and there's a Round Peak church. And there's about a dozen musicians that came along that were born probably around the turn of the century, something like that. And they took after the Charlie Lowe style of banjo playing, which was pretty intricate. I would say the banjo style is one of the ways that you can tell, along with the fiddling was a little different. Rather than like the Galax style, old-time fiddling that you played kind of on the tip of the bow, the Round Peak style you played more in the middle of the bow, giving you more volume, and you could play more strings at a time for big full notes. A lot of the music in Round Peak, to take for instance Tommy Jarrell, which is one of the more well-known fiddle players from that area. His father, Ben Jarrell, was also a fiddle player. So they took after that back generation that they learned from as a kid going around, and that the people didn't travel very much. So the musicians that grew up in the Round Peak area held on to the music of their family that was kind of passed on. And if they got new tunes and traveled out, they would have to learn them right there at the spot and then go back to Round Peak and learn them. And they all took on this kind of orientation of the rhythm and drive that was different than the music even say a couple of miles away, 5 miles away in Dobson or something like that, just because people didn't travel as much back then. They were farmers and they used the music for entertainment, you know, at night. So
sure. Yeah, that's the key too, yeah. The entertainment portion of it. And it's this particular dance style that seems to get people up and lively and out on the floor.
It was really, for dancing for sure.
That it really does. Playing that style of music and then going around to other venues and you see people light up and how eager they are to get on out there and start dancing. It's a participatory music. It's not, you know, it's not to just be played and somebody sit and listen and passively and not for individual artists necessarily to stand out. It's a dance music that's participatory for the band, who enjoys playing with each other, presumably, and also you interact with the dancers out front.
Well, it seems like that's one thing that the Surrey Old Time Fiddlers Convention does so well, is it kind of brings back those traditions in its own setting. I mean, dance is a huge part of the convention, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge part, and that's one of the main focuses and points of the Fiddlers Convention, was that it takes place in the very center of the county, and it invites people to come out and participate and enjoy it as a community event. And several occasions I've had individuals make a comment that it feels like an old community dance when they come there, and so that's what I want.
And in the last 5 years, I feel like that Friday night dance has become more of kind of like a big community county party, because you see people there you don't normally get to see all the time, and they all come out to either watch the people dance. Because even if you're of a younger generation, you still appreciate the dancing and watching the people dance, because the people feverishly dance, and the dance floor is huge, and they just fill it up, and it's an amazing sight. And so it's kind of like a big reunion. So it's something to come out and see. You know, that's a dying thing nowadays, and it's good to get to see it.
You'd mentioned in terms of Round Peak style, even a different banjo style. Is it somewhere between clawhammer and like three finger style? How would you describe that?
Well, no, it's still clawhammer. It's more of the banjo. Usually, sometimes it can be fretted or fretless, but the notes are kind of picked out. The thumb string is hit in kind of an unusual way, but they all kind of pattern it after Charlie Lowe. Evidently, Charlie Lowe must have been a heck of a banjo player, and he lived, he was an old man at the turn of the century, I would say. You know, he was an old man when Tommy was young, when all these people were young, like Kyle Creed and folks like that. My grandfather, Dix Freeman, learned from that style.
Okay.
So he was a big influence on that community, and he just kind of had a different way of doing it than more of like the Virginia style was more frailing with picking involved. There's just so many different styles, and even amongst Round Peak picking, everybody that played it a different way.
Right, but in combination with that, I think the Round Peak style also focuses on melody playing.
Right, melody playing, exactly, with the fiddle and banjo and all the instruments. Basically,
and the singers as well, yeah, when the singing takes place.
Well, it used to be fiddle and banjo music.
When you say melody style, I would think, well, it's a melodic instrument. What else would they play? Could you break down the difference for me, Buck?
The melody line is being concentrated on and focused on, and then there's background rhythm to that accentuates the dancing.
Well, a lot of styles of fiddling and stuff, it variates more like bluegrass or jazz. You get off it variates from the melody line. You can hear it in there, but like in a bluegrass fiddle break, it might go with the melody and go with the singing, but it's not like playing the direct melody of the song, you know, what you would be singing if you were singing the song.
Yeah, I got you. Basically. As opposed to just flat out improvising and just going with the harmonies and going off on your own.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Exactly. I think that's what's trying
to
be.
Which, of course, in jazz you do, and blues you do. And
sure.
You know, it's a different thing. It does it in different ways than that
it
type
It does.
Of music.
It's like if there is a move toward making the tune more intricate or varying it a little bit, everybody does it.
Another big part of the convention is competitions, and some of the competitions for the young folks and others for the old-timers and everyone in between. Why is that important?
Well, the competition, I think it, from one point of view, it keeps people sharp and on their toes because they're interested in the competition. It provides something for the spectator to see a contest on the stage, then within the musicians themselves. Some people strive to reach a champion level or win a ribbon, and other people enjoy it just for the feeling of competition and being involved. One thing that's happened, talk about the scope of it all, there were a level of musicians, the old-timers, but there weren't a lot of really young people picking it up. But the good thing is that the young people are now picking it up. It seemed like for a while there just weren't young people around. They weren't at all interested in it. And now there are several programs in the schools, like the Junior Appalachian Musicians Program and so forth, that kids can do instrument workshops after school, an after-school program.
And you've been involved with that, haven't you, Nick?
Yeah, I've taught it to several of the jam programs, and it's really a great thing, and they really bring out some good musicians.
during the individual competition during the day. Young people can come at any point and mix in with the adults, and you hear a lot of really amazing young musicians. It amazes me how different the scope of it all has become in terms of quality of music that you hear.
Some of the luthiers on this play. Could you kind of describe that level of artistry for some of the makers out there?
In the Knight's Grill, it's the cafeteria there that has great food, and that's open all day Saturday. In the cafeteria there, there will be five or six, maybe seven luthiers, depending on how many can make it. They'll have instruments on display, and occasionally they'll be working on some aspect of construction if it's simple enough to bring in.
Oh, nice. So you can actually see them in process.
Yeah, it's possible to see, or at least stages of development.
Sure.
And so that's neat. It's a different aspect of it. Gives people a chance to see some really fine instruments being constructed right there.
Yeah, this is such a great community resource in so many different ways. I mean, if you're a young musician, or even if you're just a music appreciator, you get to participate in. These are free workshops coming up.
That's exactly right. This is the fifth year we've offered the free workshops, and always excited, and always just have master musicians giving the workshops. And this year we're really excited. At 1 o'clock on Saturday, we're having Eddie Bond coming down from Galax. He's a Galax style fiddle player. He's really awesome. He's won the Galax Fiddlers Convention and all kinds of awards, and plays in numerous bands. And so he's coming down to do the fiddle workshop.
Hey, Nick, what marks the Galax style of fiddle playing?
Well, that's, like I said, he does more fiddling on the tip end of his bow, out on the far end, and it's a little bit more delicate noting. They try to play a little bit prettier than they do in Round Peak. You know, it's less drive and more intricate, maybe some more overtones of the Irish type fiddling or something from the old world. And it's all, you know, dance music, but it's there's different things. And of course, Eddie plays all different styles, but the Galax style is what he's known for.
And then we've got NPR's own Paul Brown on the menu coming up.
That's exactly right. He's coming to do a banjo workshop, and he's an awesome banjo player as well, fiddle player. He does everything, and he's got a really unique banjo style, and a great teacher, and just a great person all the way around. It's be worth taking the banjo workshop just to get to hang out with Paul.
Yeah, Paul played with many of the ones we call the older musicians, the ones that have passed on, and he had the opportunity to play with them.
Not only has he been a great radio personality, back in the 80s, he went around to all the old people that were living that played music all around North Carolina and Southwest Virginia, and made recordings and hung out and learned his style. You know, he can mimic a lot of different styles on banjo and fiddle of all these people that are dead. And, you know, if he hadn't have done that, people might not even have heard of these people. It's a great resource.
And I know, speaking of great resources, I know you know nothing about this guitarist in the program. What's it, Chester somebody? What's this guy?
Yeah, Chester McMillan. He's going to give the guitar workshop at 3 o'clock, and he has a really unique style. He's my father. I've learned a lot of music from him, and he's played with all the greats, from people from North Carolina, Southwest Virginia. Even played blues music with the Fardrails from over towards Stuart, Virginia, and all types of music. And he gives a good guitar workshop, and he's a great person to meet. And he's also a master artist winner at our Fiddlers Convention.
So he won a big award this year.
Yes, he won the Brown Hudson Folklore Award, and that's given out by the North Carolina Folklore Society, and we're real proud of him. And we went down, and it was a great time, wasn't it, Buck?
Yeah, the neat thing, it was their 100th anniversary,
wow,
as it turns out, of the society. We played as part of it, too. It was a great day to go down and do that.
Nice.
Then at 4 o'clock, we're going to have Mark Handy doing the dance workshop. He's a fine dancer and been doing it for a long time. And he brings in a style of dancing from up around Ennis, North Carolina, which is over kind of close to Sparta. So he'll be doing the dance workshop at 4. So a great day of workshops, as well as a lot of other things going on.
What aspect of the convention are you looking forward to most this year, Buck? Hmm. There's so many.
Well, to be selfish about it, my aspect is it's like a big family homecoming for me. My granddaughter's been to every one of them, and family from lots of places and associated people that have known for years and feel like they're family. That's really a big deal for me personally. On the more community-spirited level, I guess, it's just really nice to see that many people having that much fun. And it's totally a nonprofit benefit thing in addition to being a fun thing to do. It's a good thing for the community and the county.
Surrey Old Time Fiddlers Convention organizer Nick McMillan plays fiddle in Backstep. He's a first place winner at both Mount Airy and Galax, Virginia Fiddlers Conventions. He was joined by co-organizer Buck Buckner. Buck plays the bass in Backstep, he sings, and he's chairman of the Surrey County Planning Board. For nearly 30 years, Backstep has been carrying on the traditional sounds of old time music found in the foothills along the North Carolina and Virginia border, and they've been doing it very, very well. We've been sampling from the band's recording, Hell Amongst the Round Peakers, and you'll find links to more of their music at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. This year's Surrey Old Time Fiddlers Convention is Friday, March 28th through the 29th at the Surrey Community College in Dobson, North Carolina. Friday night's dance will feature Backstep along with the Mountain Park Old Time Band and the Slate Mountain Ramblers. On Saturday, it'll be competitions with Master Artist Awards given to outstanding local musicians. They're open to old and young alike, keeping this wonderful cultural style of dance and music thriving well into the future. There'll be free workshops on Saturday, too, with renowned Galax-style fiddler Eddie Bond, award-winning guitarist Chester McMillan, dancer Mark Handy, and NPR's own Paul Brown will offer a banjo workshop. You'll find links to the complete lineup at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Andre Wallace. You'll find links, photos, and video clips of the artists on our website, WFDD.org. Click on Triad Arts Weekend, and you'll also find podcasts and archived episodes. Check in with us on Facebook and Twitter now and again. And you can always email us with your questions and comments. It's triadarts@wfu.edu. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.